So, hello everyone, and welcome to what is now episode 5, I've done this 5 times now, of the series I've now called Valhalla Conversations, where I meet creatives of like-mindedness who likes Vikings, Viking Age, and of course Norse mythology, because they're the two parts of the same coin, which I absolutely adore. And I'm delighted to welcome today, on my 5th episode, Kate Hartfield, author of this wonderful book. I do encourage everyone to go buy it. I mean, just look at that cover. Just look at that lovely cover. Of course, ignore the Thor's hammer. It's all about this person right here, this person. But we shall dive into more about that. So, Kate, would you like to introduce yourself and your wonderful works?
Hello, thank you. I'm so excited to be here. This is a wonderful project, and yeah, I'm just looking forward to the conversation. So I am a writer who lives in Canada. I live just outside of Ottawa, and I used to be a journalist, and I've written about 5 novels that have been published. I say about as if it's like not a discrete number. So a few novels of my own, including The Valkyrie, The Embroidered Book, which is a big novel about Marie Antoinette and her sister. And I have a medieval novel called The Chatelaine. And I have more novels coming out shortly. And I've also written a couple of tie-in novels for Assassin's Creed, the video game franchise. Short fiction and interactive fiction. So all kinds of storytelling in different formats.
Brilliant. Well, of course, today is specifically about this one, which I only discovered myself last summer due to a secret project that I'm not announcing just yet, dear viewers. It's still being finalised. Kate is one of the privileged few that knows. but yes, so I, if anyone follows me on Twitter, Instagram, well, what used to be Twitter, Instagram threads, they'll know that I love Norse mythology, and particularly Valkyries, hence why I'm surrounded by all the different books and comics featuring Valkyries that I have read, followed, some brilliant, some okay. Most of them are good. I do recommend most of what I have on my bookshelf. But this one went straight to the top of my number one list, Kate, when I finished it. I read it in 5 days, which, as a mum of a toddler, very active toddler, who's 3 going on 13, was an amazing feat, because I haven't read that quickly for some time since becoming a mum. So I guess we'll start off with the beginning, and like, how did you get the idea to write the Valkyrie?
Yeah, like many books, I think this came from a few different streams all joining together to make a river, and you know, a few different places that were bouncing around in my mind. So probably the actual moment when it was born was a night when I was reading bedtime stories to my kid. He was, I think, about 9 years old at the time. He's 14 now. And he loves mythology and folklore and history. And so we kind of share an interest in that kind of thing. And he had several books on his shelf about Norse mythology. You know, some of them written more for kids, some of them not. And it was probably the Neil Gaiman Norse mythology book that we were reading. And we came across the story. That book does have a short version of the Brynhild and Sigurd story in it. And, you know, we were reading that together, and maybe another couple of Norse myths that week. And I was doing a short fiction contest for a writer's group that I'm a part of called Codex. And we have this flash fiction contest every year. And it's, the idea is to write a very short story over a weekend, 750 words over a weekend. And I was inspired to write this very short story about Brynhild from her perspective, because when I read this story, I thought, when I was reading the myth, I had read it before, but it just really struck me that there were things about Brynhild's side of the story that didn't ring true to me, that it just didn't make sense. I thought, well, I'm just going to write from her perspective. So I wrote this 750 word story. And my co-writers who read it said, oh, well, this is great, but it's not a 750 word story. This is a novel. You know? So I had the beginning of the novel from there. And that was really the spark of it. But there were some other things then that, as I read the research and I started to think about, okay, well, what story do I want to tell? Then it grew from there.
Because of course, dear viewer and reader, listener, whatever, this book is a dual narrative. It's told, of course, from Brynhild. The fallen Valkyrie, the only Valkyrie, has a real showpiece in legend and lore. But it's also told from the point of view of Gudrun, the kind of like unfortunate sister to King Gunnar, and the whole love quartet that's more complicated than Romeo and Juliet by far. So how did you decide to make it a two-dual, like, feminine narrative as well?
Yeah, so where I came from with that was, I was immediately drawn to the story of Brunhilde because she is, she's many different things in many different versions of the story. So the two main streams of source material that we have are, you know, the Norse mythology, the prose Eddas, the prose and poetic Eddas, mm-hmm. and the Song of the Volsungs, and we'll probably get into that. And mm-hmm. over on the Germanic side, there are several medieval poems, and the biggest one is the Nibelungenlied, which is this big epic poem. Some of the names are different, but most of the story is pretty much the same. Mm-hmm. With some important changes, which again we can get into. But when I was reading all this source material, Brunhilde herself, you know, sometimes she's a sorceress, sometimes she's a mm-hmm. witch, sometimes she's a queen over the water. But in the Norse versions, she's a fallen Valkyrie. And so I thought she was a really interesting figure. So that's where I began. So I didn't really begin with this idea of the two women talking to each other. But as I started reading to research the story, I was really struck by their relationship. And they're often portrayed as these bitter rivals that end up bringing everything down, bringing on catastrophe because of their jealousy of each other. But when I was reading, I've got it right here beside me, the Song of the Nibelungs, which is a translation by Margaret Armour. And this is actually from the Tolkien's bookshelf.
Oh, very nice.
I was really struck by how there's these phrases about, like, saying things like when these two women saw each other in the hall, they couldn't take their eyes off each other. And, you know, when they saw each other, they embraced warmly. And there was just all this sense of a really passionate relationship there, even before they become enemies and rivals. And so eventually it just dawned on me that the easiest way to tell a different version of the story that made sense, and to me even made more sense in some ways than what has come down to us, was to wonder what would the story have looked like to them if they were actually in love. So that's where the dual narrative came from, with them being, who tells the story and who listens to the story is so important in retellings. It was important to me to have them be both the tellers and also the audience, in a sense, that this is a contained universe in which they're telling each other the story.
Mm. I must admit, kind of like when I first started reading it, the way Brunhilde starts referring to her past, but also in the present tense, it was like, okay, what's happening? She's like, my beginning, but then my other beginning. I'm like, okay, which I'll just carry on and eventually make sense. And of course, by the end, it all does, because you realise it's like one of those films that starts you in the middle and then it takes you back to the beginning and then it works your way through. And of course, it is really refreshing, and of course, highly relevant to kind of like 21st, 22nd, dare I say, century values today, about kind of like equality and independent women and that kind of thing, about kind of getting against the hierarchy, so to speak, to have these strong two female voices, because of course the legends focus mainly on what the men get up to. So it's Sigurd that goes and kills the dragon, it's Sigurd who wakes Brunhilde, it's Sigurd who woos her and goes after the treasure, and it's Regan who I always found was a really weird wormy type character. He often reminds me of a character from Harry Potter that I can't remember the name of. I want to say Wormwood, but I could be wrong.
I know the one you mean. Yeah. I remember
him specifically because it was in the Prisoner of Azkaban and he betrays Harry Potter and his newly found uncle and that whole shebang. Mm-hmm. It just really came back when I reread the Saga of the Volsungs after, of course, rereading yours. And that's what it really made me notice. And I'm still rereading it as part of my secret project and doing some analysis there, dear listeners, about the changes and adaptations you've introduced. So you've not just told it from a different point of view, but you have restructured events, repositioned characters in different ways. I guess the most significant one for me is the way that you've had Brunhilde not be the stereotypical, the stereotype that everyone knows of, like, the damsel in distress is the damsel in the fire that you've got to go and kiss away. Very much alike to Sleeping Beauty. The kind of like, I know in Wagner he made Odin put her to sleep and put the Ring of Fire, but in your mm-hmm. book she chose to do that because it was she who mm-hmm. wanted to take on Fafnir, hearing it from the birds, which I actually love the mm-hmm. idea of her learning language from the birds, and of course learning mm-hmm. it from other Valkyries and Odin, which makes sense because he spoke to ravens, so it's mm-hmm. aptly connects beautifully with the mythology. But were there any pieces and adaptations that you made that you were a bit unsure of, or were you quite confident in going forward and making those changes that you made? I'm trying not to spoil it too much mm-hmm. for dear viewers.
Yeah, yeah, it was always a little bit, you know, I felt a strong sense of responsibility to the history of the narrative and to all of the storytellers who had gone before me, and to the ongoing story, you know, that's this living thing over time and will continue to live on long past mm-hmm. me in various forms. So I did feel some responsibility to that, to treat it respectfully and to do my best to make a story that felt true and felt like it honored the history of the story. At the same time, you know, the sources are all so contradictory and have different versions going on. And so I really felt like there was no single canon version that I could possibly portray, in a sense, you know, because mm-hmm. there are different, almost every scene or part of the story is told in slightly different ways, especially in the Norse versus the Germanic versions mm-hmm. of it. And even within particular cultural traditions or language traditions, there are still contradictions and changes in the story. So I had a strong sense that storytellers have been kind of messing with this for many years and have been introducing things that made sense to them or spoke to their moment in time or how they saw the important themes that they wanted to bring out. So when it came time to sort of reinterpret an event in the story and look at it from a different angle and maybe even change the facts that led up to it, I felt like that was almost in a way honoring that tradition because it has been changed and played around with so much that that, you know, it's not set in stone or ossified. It's a living narrative that changes all the time. So that part of it, when Brunhild is sleeping, you know, she does put herself to sleep. And I was really fascinated with the role of sleep in fairy tales. As you say, Sleeping Beauty, you know, this story was probably a source for Sleeping Beauty because it has this idea of pricking the finger on a thorn and falling asleep and being woken by a man who comes along and wakes her up. And as a mom, as you will understand, I felt very strongly that, you know, sleep is so powerful. And so, you know, the idea that it was a curse for a woman seems very prevalent in stories. And from the woman's perspective, I thought, you know what, sleep is where we get our strength.
Yep.
So, yeah. So I think, you know, it seemed to me like if somebody wanted to have a spell that would put them to sleep, I thought, well, what about looking at it from the other side and thinking about it as a source of strength rather than a curse? And so that's where that came from.
The other thing, kind of like, I know I mentioned it earlier, was kind of like rereading the Saga of the Volsungs that I didn't really notice or realise, because I have read it before many years ago, and it obviously mm-hmm. I think I walked away just thinking, oh, Odin, he's such a manipulator, he makes all the bad mm-hmm. things happen effectively. We'll get mm-hmm. on to him in another minute because he's a another important character underlying all this, and I think you've done that brilliantly. But it was when Sigurd and Brynhild in the Saga of the Volsungs have that long talk and she's sharing her wisdom about the runes and this, that. I thought you've done really well to adapt that, all those little verses about using runes and ale and using runes and fire and healing and birchwood and that kind of thing, to make it very practical and almost like very believable, very physical magic as well, like not just like using the runes to kind of like give her that sleep boost, to give almost like an adrenaline rush, almost akin to, I don't know, Captain America going into a capsule, I suppose.
Yeah.
To give it a modern analogy. But also, because I've been rereading up to the point where she is with Gunnar and Gudrun and their family, and of course Sigurd's there, and there's that bitterness simmering away, and of course Gudrun's mum asks her to help strengthen the stones in the bridge. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting, kind of like using runes, not just in like a magical, oh, I will heal you of your ailments kind of thing and I will bring fire forth from out of nowhere, but I'm actually going to make a bridge more stable. I thought that was a really clever twist.
Oh, nice. Yeah, good. Yeah. Yeah, that was one of those places where I think all of the you know, sort of background ideas of the story and then my own plot and trying to fit this into the historical narrative, you know, all kind of came together, and it just made sense to me that, you know, Brynhild would be involved in kind of strengthening the fortifications of the city. And, you know, so one thing that I have found that many people who are not familiar with the source material don't know is that this is a historical narrative and that it does refer to the actual historical event of what we now call Worms, Germany, you know, the city on the edge of the Rhine. It was then sort of the edge of the Roman Empire at the time. And when Attila and the Huns came over, it was one of the first places that felt their wrath and ended up leading to the exile and migration of the Burgundian people into what is now Burgundy, France. So all of that historical part of it, I think, is not very well understood. And so I get a lot of questions from people like, why did you put this in a real historical setting? And But most of the source material actually does refer to this historical event, even if it's somewhat obscured now behind different names and different, you know, the fantasy and all the rest of it. So that part of it, of the city on the Rhine with a bridge, you know, it seemed like it was really central to, you know, what their concerns would be, you know, how to fortify this city and how to be strong. And so, you know, I brought in Brynhild's magic into that, I think, as a way to kind of bring it all together into a story that would seem to make sense to me.
Well, I really admired it, because I've read in various Norse fantasy books runes and runic magic being used, and it has always been kind of like done as a high fantasy thing, kind of like how described these runes on the floor and the trap will appear and that kind of thing. But it's yours seems simple, but not like on a mundane level, but simple and a very kind of like, okay, yeah, that I can see how that would work, kind of makes sense. And of course, as well as Gudrun and Brynhild, you've also got Auda, Gudrun's mum, who is also a bit of a sorceress of sorts. And I like, because I wasn't really aware of her character much in the source text of the Saga of the Volsungs. I've yet to ring the Nibelungenlied. If I can ever pronounce the word.
No, me neither,
The one with the Nibelungs. But I remember, of course, her key role was almost being the main, not the enabler that helped Gunnar get Brynhild, because she was the one that weaves the disguise out of air and magic to enable Sigurd to go through the fire, because Gunnar wouldn't, and Sigurd's horse wouldn't either, even with Gunnar on it, which I thought was that. And of course, the other thing that I noticed rereading, and I'm kind of going all over the place with my questions here, so apologies, I just so many ideas and so many brilliant adaptations, was I do remember at least hearing an audio version retelling of the Saga of the Volsungs from the wonderful hosts of that Jorvik Viking thing podcast. They got some wonderful Jorvik team members to narrate the whole thing. And I remember hearing how Sigurd was goaded by Regan to go get a really good horse. And he goes there, and an old man wonderfully appears and says, oh, drive them all into the river and see which one still swims. But of course, in your one, Odin, which of course it is, dear viewers, Odin, the old man on the road is always Odin. He's not Gandalf, it's Odin. Although Gandalf was probably very much based on Odin. Tolkien being who he was, just says, oh, this horse belongs to a traitor and he doesn't want to work for the traitor anymore, so you can have him. And that's how Granny, the famous horse of the name, becomes Sigurd's horse, even though he was Brynhild's in your telling. So I kind of like how you really explored, and that was the first of many instances that explored the reason why Brynhild is in Midgard, the mortal realm, to begin with, is her disagreement, her feud, her argument of sorts, for various reasons, with Odin. Because in the Saga of the Volsung, she says, oh, I kind of like favoured one king, I defended the other, he killed mine, even though I wanted him to live, and we just disagreed, and so I was punished and sent away. And I really like how you explored that a bit more, especially kind of like with Brynhild's first initial chapter, and her reflection, how she was so faithful and beholden to him as a Valkyrie, kind of like she was grateful for the training and the powers and sort of ability, and she was almost hero worshipping him in her loyalty to degree. And then when she learned that just by doing what she's doing, she then gets told off in a way for doing it. And that's one thing that's always made me drawn, I think, to the Valkyrie characters, in that they're kind of like, they're free, but they're not free. They're not quite under control directly, but he very much I tried to describe it once as kind of like Odin's using them as kind of like talent recruiters. They go off and recruit talent for the war, mm-hmm. for the war kind of thing. But he always has the last shot. Although in this mm-hmm. case, of course, Brynhild disagrees because he taught her to judge them. She's judged them. But then he says mm-hmm. no. So it's a case of kind of like almost knowing when, as certainly as a character and as a woman in any context, to step and say, no, I believe I'm right mm-hmm. kind of thing. I'm not just going to bow to what you say. And of mm-hmm. course, when he appears to her within the first few pages and kind of says, oh, hi, how are you doing? And she's like, mm-hmm. leave me alone.
yeah.
I really love how you've explored that relationship. And it carries on mostly at the beginning and then, of course, near the end, where she realises a lot of truths about mm-hmm. Odin's manipulation, not just of her, but of course behind Fafnir, because Fafnir mm-hmm. was, in your retelling, a kind of like a creation of sorts from Odin. Odin enabled Fafnir mm-hmm. to go from a human to that kind of dragon-esque form, because mm-hmm. of course there's the legend of Ottar and Regin and Fafnir and Ottar's hide being covered in gold, and that's how the cursed ring of the Nibelung gets involved, mm-hmm. which I think is another thing going slightly off topic. My brain is just all over. There's so many wonderful things about your book that you don't really put a lot of emphasis on the cursed ring. I mean, Fafnir mm-hmm. does mention that there's a curse of sorts. It'll bring doom, it'll mm-hmm. bring death. But yeah. he doesn't mention anything specifically. And yet, yeah. those of us who know familiar, at least mm-hmm. vaguely familiar, even with Wagner's kind of version, that like, oh, the ring that Brynhild picks is definitely going to be that one ring.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And that's all, you know, that was all just in my mind as well when I was writing. And, you know, that, as you say, the sort of overarching story with Odin, that is probably the biggest change that I brought to the book, I think, you know, and it's not really a change in the sense that you're right. It's all drawing on pieces of the story. But the idea that Odin had this, you know, plan for the whole, and I'll try not to spoil as well, but like the idea that this all sort of connects together a little bit more was me trying to make, you know, to tell this as a modern story, because, you know, there are parts of the old epics and sagas that, you know, there's one set of characters goes and does something and then something else happens later on. And there's not really necessarily any connection between them, because I think the older traditions, there was not an expectation that there would be. A person could go and have an adventure over here. Same character could go have an adventure over here. But to make it a modern coherent novel, there is that question of, okay, well, how are these things connected, or what's, you know, what's the overarching story? So I think I did push on that a little bit. I did draw inspiration from real stories about what was happening with Odin and Brynhild, but I sort of put it all together in a way. So that's probably the biggest change. And the other big change, as you mentioned, I think, is that I do not emphasize the ring very much. You know, it's kind of there as a, you know, if you know the story, you're going to recognize it. But you know, I think partly because I just felt like that aspect of it was so explored, both by the Wagner opera and also because the way that most people are familiar with the story, I think, or one way that a lot of people are familiar with the story is through Tolkien, you know, because Tolkien did draw on this source material. And so the idea of a cursed ring associated with a dragon, you know, I think we already kind of have a story about that in our heads. And so it would have been a real challenge, I think, to tell a different story about that for me. And so I wanted to just shift it a little bit and say, well, look over here at this part of it instead.
Well, the other thing that I really liked, and I'm trying to think about how not to spoil things, is that in one scene further on in the book, in the narrative that you've told, you've really embraced kind of like Brynhild's past life as a Valkyrie in Valkyrie. Mm-hmm. I keep saying it wrong, I keep pronouncing the I too much.
Valkyrie, oh, I don't know.
I will get it right. Erased her past and brought that on in various ways. Like, for instance, there is a chance meeting with Loki, which again you've depicted as a feminine form, which for many of us now familiar with the Tom Hiddleston version of Loki and that whole cinematic universe spin-off, mm-hmm. it's quite aware that he is a shapeshifter and very much gender fluid, and he mm-hmm. is a very wonderfully interesting character. And although he's got a very brief, I say he, she, they have a very brief brief appearance, their dialogue was really interesting. So I remember reading just before I came on to do this interview, that kind of like that conversation where Brynhild is like, it sounds like you're giving me a warning, and that's not usual for a god of mischief. And he goes, warnings are the best source of mischief, because you can either interpret them one way or the other, or you don't know what the warning is about or about the timing, kind of thing. And then, of course, you've broadened it a little bit further in that there's a conflict in the background of sorts between Odin and Freya. And then your brilliant expanded ending of sorts, like an alternative ending to the Saga of the Volsungs that should have been there and that wasn't, which I like. I really like that bit. Was kind of like after Brynhild puts herself on the pyre and burns. Mm-hmm. And that's, for me, as a fan of anything to do with Valkyries, was absolutely mind-blowing how you really then explored the mechanics and the role and the duty and the almost weight of responsibility to juggling power of respect for the dead or the dying, because they choose the dead and then they die. They don't choose from the dead. And then, of course, kind of like answering to Odin and knowing how to keep a balance of where people go, because I'm going to say it just because Odin is an underwriting force for a lot of the conflicts building, both kind of like on a personal level to a kind of continental level, aka Attila the Hun and all that jazz, so to speak, which really reflects Odin's character so well, because so many times he's come up in modern media, he's just not depicted, I think, as the knowledge hungry and power crazed and almost like war starved god that he is, because he's always paranoid about Ragnarok. And I love how there is a line quite near the beginning where I think kind of like, what do you dream about, Odin? He goes, oh, I dream about people taking away my power, that kind of thing. That's a brilliant red light, like, oh, he's got that underlying paranoia there. He's very much a control freak, like wants it all for himself. And I know I'm just rambling. I do have questions in here somewhere.
It's all good.
But you, of course, explore kind of like not just like the balance of power, because Freya is certainly a powerful female entity in Norse mythology, because, of course, she brings the cedar magic that Odin then, of course, pilfers, because he's just pilfering knowledge here left and centre. But, of course, the often overlooked and unheard of spiritual role of Disir versus Valkyries, because I've read about Disir in various non-fiction books as being alternative female spirits, and how they're sometimes around to almost be like the fairy godmother to kind of guide people to the good path or try and stay away from the bad path. But I like how you set them up as very much, because often Freya is depicted as like the goddess of the Valkyries, but of course they answer to Odin, not to Freya, even though Freya canonically does select half the dead to go to her hole in Fogvang. So again, that's a really interesting balance you've explored, and I would love to know your thoughts on how and why you wrote what you did.
It was a real challenge for me to decide how to incorporate that Norse mythology, and especially because people's knowledge of Norse mythology today, I think, is going to be bits and pieces, as why wouldn't it be, little parts of it that are better known than others. The Marvel Cinematic Universe has I think introduced a lot of characters in slightly different forms and different ways, which I love, but it does sort of create an entry for people that are going to be having those particular characters in mind, and then coming into the original mythology, it might actually seem sort of unfamiliar, so I thought a lot about how to incorporate that, and I was really taken with the duality or the binary between Freya and Odin, and the Aesir and the Vanir, this idea that there are these two groups of gods that that had warred and fought, and there was a truce, and there were some deals and bargains, and magic was all part of the bargain and everything else. So none of that really gets explained completely in my novel, because it's not really about that, but that's sort of the backdrop, that there are these power dynamics happening with the gods themselves, and that explains some of their behavior. So I think that for people who know that the mythology in more detail, they can understand what's happening there. And I hope that readers who don't will at least, you know, get this sense of what the some of the relationships are. And I tried to just put them on the page that and these are, you know, different, these are my versions of Freya and Odin, you know, like they're always going to be, every interpretation is going to be different. But I really did love that that idea. And it was a challenge too, you know, I did want to have, I needed to have the afterlife present in some sense in this book, because, you know, this is such a big part of what Valkyries do, as you say, it's central to them. But I had, you know, I had to think about how am I going to interpret this for a modern audience and explain the concept of the multiple afterlives, and how does that make sense in a novel in which you've got, it's set in the real world where you will have, you know, Christians and Jews and, you know, not Muslims yet, but, you know, like all Zoroastrians and, you know, different faith systems, including old versions of what we would now think of as sort of Viking belief happening as well in Europe, and how to be respectful of all of that. Anyway, so now I'm rambling, but this all sort of went into this too, you know, and I thought of, okay, well, how am I going to make an afterlife in this novel that makes sense with all of that and feels like it could be integrated into the real world in some way, but also honors the stories that this comes from. So I really loved, it was just one of my favorite parts of the book was writing the realm of Hel and the realm of Freya. And this, you know, because they're not as well known as the male dominated afterlife of Valhalla.
Yeah, I really like that. And of course it made me have a light bulb. I thought, oh yeah, kind of like, because in your book you depict that Brynhild became a Valkyrie through some sort of human sacrifice when she was a little girl. And I quite liked the image you depicted of Odin taking her hand and leading her off, and then 6 years later she's a train and fled Valkyrie. It instantly made me think for some reason of I think it's on Netflix, of the Echo series that Marvel's done with Kingpin having that little girl come under thing. I haven't seen it, so I don't know anything about that kind of comic thing, but it just made me think of that particular scene. But of course then she's technically dead already, so then when she comes back to mortal life, yes, she's kind of like living again, but then the biggest and I think the most delightful twist is that in your retelling, I should say, you've not just have Sigurd bathed in Fafnir's blood, but you've also had Brynhild do it, simply because they were both together when they killed Fafnir, and Sigurd is the one that I'm much like, oh look, I can stab my hand and nothing happens. And I just love kind of like how he just remarks upon that after she's just woken up from her own ordeal of the battle. And the scene, it's a very visceral scene you describe of her bathing, and I thought that was, it made my stomach churn for her.
it's gross
But then of course they're kind of like, they're immortal, or at least can't be killed by blade, so to speak, unless apart from Sigurd, of course, with his one spot behind his shoulder, which I always thought was a leaf, partly because I grew up watching the Sword of Xanten film adaptation. I don't know if you've seen the Sword of Xanten before.
No, I haven't.
I will have to ping you over the details. It should be out there on DVD somewhere. It's been out for a good 10 years or so. But that's a really nice film adaptation of the Saga of the Volsungs from the Nibelungenlied and that kind of thing. And it's a leaf that falls on his shoulder, and that's what stops that spot getting protected by the magic of Fafnir's blood. But in the battle, it's Brynhild, because she pushes him out of the way before he gets jumped, as he usually does. I'm trying not to. I'll speak about Sigurd. No, I'll speak about Sigurd in a minute. What I was trying to say was about how, of course, in the canonical story, Brynhild does kind of throw herself on the pyre with Sigurd. But in this case, they have two separate pyres. And I wasn't sure, and I'm sure you can correct me on this, because I haven't quite reread the full ending yet. But I remember when Sigurd first tasted Fafnir's heart's blood, being like, oh, it hurts, but it doesn't burn. So then I'm like, okay, well, how do you burn their bodies then if they're also fireproof? And thus I wasn't sure how Brynhild was able to die for a second time in the pyre, because she wasn't burning. But I know obviously you can die from smoke inhalation, but I don't know if that's what killed her. Sorry if I'm thinking that too practically.
no, it absolutely, I had the same thought process. So it is, you know, there's a little bit of ambiguity, I think, in my telling of the story, in terms of Brynhild's status, you know, as whether she's completely mortal or not. And she's at the beginning of the book, you know, she's quite clear that, you know, Odin has made her a woman again. And she always was, you know, like my sort of hand wavy approach to what the Valkyries are. Like, as you say, I've decided that they started as humans in my particular version of them. And they just don't age because they're usually in Valhalla and they live very, very long times, but they still age a little bit. So she is just a mortal in my conception of her, but she does bathe in Fafnir's blood, which confers this invulnerability to her skin. And maybe she's got like a little bit of extra something special, you know, because she used to be a Valkyrie. So she does manage to survive this fall. But it's surviving in a very strange and mythic way because she does go to the underworld, right? So it's sort of half and half. And when she gets there, Hel says, you know, like, what's going on? Something's odd about you that you're not quite living, not quite dead. And I think I was partly just trying to sort of make sense of the stories in the source material themselves, you know, because as you say, she does go onto a pyre in the story, and then being a mythological tale, there's then these other things, like there's a poem called The Hell Ride of Brynhild, which explains talks about her going down into the underworld, you know, there are aspects of the story that continue even after death, and so I needed to sort of find a way to tell that and still have her be embodied in some way in a kind of modern conception, like, you know, because the questions of like, well, is she living or is she dead? I think we're, you know, every society will think about that in different ways. So that's sort of where I was coming from there in terms of how can we have this moment feel real and feel embodied and corporeal, but also draw in some of these sort of mythic stories about afterlives and impossible happenings. And it's, I think, one of the things that inspired that to some degree as well is the novel The Hero in the Crown. Have you ever read that one?
No, not heard that one.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with Norse mythology, but it's a novel by Robin McKinley that was really influential when I was growing up on me, and I've read it many times, and it is about a dragon slayer. It's about a female dragon slayer. And so I think that novel inspired a lot of how I conceived of Fafnir. But also I think just in general, it was always in the back of my mind, and the character in The Hero in the Crown also has a kind of ambiguous relationship with mortality by the end of it.
Okay.
So, you know, she bathes in a lake, and it's like, you know, she's not quite human at the end, but she mostly is. And so I think that idea of, you know, there's some sort of magic happening that it's not quite making sense. That was always really appealing to me. And that probably came in part from The Hero in the Crown as well.
Well, thank you. That is really interesting to hear, because it's made me think back to, because I was reading just before we both came online, the scene where Gudrun is in the tent with Brynhild. I'm not going to say location or place in the story, but they're in a tent. And Gudrun is quite innocently and charmingly asking Brynhild questions about the afterlife in Valhalla. And Brynhild's trying to explain it's not the body we take, it's kind of like the brain, because as Odin told her, it's the brain that distinguishes a warrior from a murderer, kind of like you take the imprint of the world on the mind, or the mind on the world, and that's what we take up. And reading that certainly made me reflect to kind of like my own experience in dabbling with Assassin's Creed Valhalla, which you may or may not be aware of from your fictional work with them, because I happily played through their discovery tour of the Viking Age, and they follow a particular character that ends up in Jotunheim because he gets killed, but he can't remember why, and he speaks to an NPC character outside Mimir as well. He's like, oh, I've given it my auger, I can't go back now, and he told me I'd find out who was the guy who did the damn dealing. And it was like, it was an interesting aspect of certainly Norse culture, or the way the Norse, and I'm speaking across broadly Scandinavia here, as well as Iceland, kind of like viewed parts of themselves as like not just a body and a soul, but all like four different elements I think they had. And I thought that was a really nice reflection of that, of you having Brynhild try and explain that to Gudrun, because I certainly wouldn't be able to explain it any better either.
yeah, that was one of the challenges for me. And I think actually that was something that I worked on in later drafts, because when I had given an early draft of this to my agent, one of her comments was, you know, I'm not quite getting how the afterlife works here. Can you, you know, what the sort of cosmology is behind this, and why, you know, why do characters believe what they believe and that kind of thing. And I can't remember exactly what I had in the early draft, but I was never quite comfortable with it. I was struggling with trying to figure out how to translate those older ideas about the self, you know, into a modern concept. I think because we do have, you know, those of us reading it now from a European or, you know, European colonial mindset are coming from a long, long history of understanding death and the soul in a certain way, you know, even if one is not religious, you know, we're just totally affected by and sort of swimming in a long culture that was affected by those ideas of the soul in several world religions. But as you say, there are some concepts of the self and the afterlife that come through from old texts that are quite different. So I thought, well, this relationship between Gudrun and Brynhild will be a good way to explore that question, because they do actually come from two different cultures within the story. And that gives me a chance for Brynhild to talk about the different ways that the afterlife pulls pieces of the self. And so you can have in a single conception of what it means to be a human, you can have stories that have ghosts and have sort of almost zombie-like revenant creatures, and you can also have Valhalla, and you can have Folkvang and Hell, and there's an undersea underworld as well, and all of this makes sense, you know. So that really was a challenge, but I was quite proud by the end of it that I felt I had explained all of that in a way without, you know, needing to say, well, let's have a long lecture now, but you know, about Plato's conception of the soul or something. But you know, it did sort of integrate itself into the novel, and I felt like it needed to be part of it for their understanding of what the afterlife was to come through to a modern reader. But it was tough to get there for sure.
Going back to, I guess, the original question about where this all began. So of course you would experiencing or exploring Norse mythology through your son, but did you have an interest in it before your son also had an interest, or was it just, did it just spark at the same time as your son was learning more?
I always have been interested in it. I've been interested in mythology in general, you know, since I was a kid, and you know, I remember reading Edith Hamilton books about mythology and just storytelling, and coming to it, I think, through modern versions of it to some extent as well, and because of Tolkien. You know, Tolkien was so inspired by this story. He read a version of the Sigurd the Dragon Slayer story in the Red Fairy Book when he was a child, and you know, and that was one of his formative experiences, so that story was always with him. And of course then Tolkien was really formative for me. I read The Lord of the Rings when I was a young teen, and have read it many times since, and it was always there for me in the back of my mind, and the love of runes from Tolkien. And so I've always been interested in it in sort of indirect fashion as well.
Cool. And have you read any kind of like Norse mythological retellings or authors that you might recommend, or books that you would recommend?
That's a good question. That's one of those questions where as soon as I get off the call, I'm going to think about three things that I should have mentioned.
I mean, I know you've mentioned Neil Gaiman's retelling of Norse myths, which I also absolutely loved. And then I went and listened to an Audible, which he self-narrates, which is even better. So I kind of like loved it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, he's brilliant. I'm trying to think. This one is not exactly exactly Norse mythology, but one of my favorite recent sort of historical looks at this sort of culture is a book called All the Horses of Iceland by Sarah, I want to say Toomey, something like that, which is a very short book, and it's a narrative sort of grounded in history about a person who travels from Iceland during the Middle Ages into Europe. But it's really informed by a lot of folklore and storytelling as well. So that's the first one that springs to mind. In terms of retellings, I know that there's something that is just in the back of my mind that I want to mention. So if it comes up to me as we're talking, I'll say, oh, this is what it is. But yeah, there's been a lot of really wonderful, illustrated books about the myths and that kind of thing coming out in the last 10 years or so. And it seems like every time I go into the store, I see another beautiful illustrated mythology edition. So it's wonderful to see. And it's such an explosion of retellings in general right now as well. Beautiful.
Well, that leads me on to my next question, because I was going to ask kind of like, how do you feel about seeing, I mean, I guess you could say kind of like more by the different mythology, but it's particular Norse mythology and just Vikings in general as the broad umbrella term that they now are. And I'm not going to mention horned helmets. No, horned helmets. kind of like has a huge surge in the last 10 years or so, because they have always been around, certainly kind of like where I come from, of course, in Britain. It's part of our history and heritage and culture, and it's always on the syllabus at some point in some year at some school, college. And I do wish I could go back and study it properly and do history all the way through from GCSE, but English, I went down the English route instead. So here I am just talking about it instead of doing lots of rereadings. But I always I'm always curious to see how people feel as a good thing, whether modern interpretations are doing anything wrong or misleading audiences or that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great thing. You know, I think it is such an elastic kind of storytelling network, I guess you could say, like the network of stories is very resilient, and I think you can't really wreck it. it's been there long before we were around, and it'll be here long after us. And I think that it's wonderful to see different interpretations coming in, and feminist and queer interpretations of the stories, which are not, as you mentioned, there's plenty of scope. There's always been gender fluidity and different concepts of sexuality and that kind of thing in Norse mythology. So it's not so much a placing of those ideas on old stories, but a kind of discovering of different historical traditions and how they can speak to us today. So I think it is really rich in material that we can use to explore what it means to be a person alive in our time. And at the same time, one of the things that I was really conscious of when I was working on this book is that the Germanic side of it, the side that was explored by Wagner and others, was really appealing to the Nazis, right? And the idea of Siegfried as this, or Sigurd or Siegfried as this, perfect Aryan hero, was a version that was their interpretation and how they used the story for their own ends. So I think that's part of it as well. And I think taking the story then and reimagining it and pulling it out of that context and confronting it in that context as well and saying, okay, well, what does it mean to be a hero, and how can we look at stories of heroes and understand how they've been used and abused and misused over the years. That's all part of the tradition as well. So so I think it is really useful for every generation to come up with their own look at old stories and the whole tradition of that story as well.
That's just made me think about, of course, the character of Sigurd, who we haven't really touched much on, because of course he is there, but he doesn't have the same spotlight as the vast array of other feminine characters, of course, including Loki, that you've got. And I remember I quite quickly became to dislike him. And I do hope that was the intention, because I think it was the way he treated Brunhild after they both killed the dragon, and he decided he was just going to go off on his own. Course, partly because he, through taking in the blood of Fafnir's heart, absorbed the knowledge that Brynhild had a talk with the birds and learned, oh, the birds are bad-mouthing about Regan and how he's going to get got and that kind of thing, and how well you kind of explored his character having almost a real, I want to say ego crisis, but it's almost like a self-esteem crisis, in that he so badly wants to be the hero because he wanted to prove himself to Regan, but now he doesn't want to go near Regan because Regan's apparently a threat. So now he's got to show himself to the world around, and how he instantly identifies Brynhild as like his weakness, his Achilles heel, because he doesn't want anyone to know that she helped him, and why he became so outraged that he learned that she was a Valkyrie, because, oh, well, you effectively cheated then because you're a superhero and you could have killed it already. You didn't need me. That kind of thing. I thought, well, that is a really interesting take, because of course in the Saga of the Volsungs, he doesn't have a lot of character, so he doesn't make in that particular saga. He just comes out across with like the typical kind of quite self-confident guy that'll just kind of like happily save a damsel, take all the wisdom, say, okay, I'm gonna marry you now, and then that's it.
And it's funny because I was talking about this book with a book club last week, and there was this, everyone said, oh, I hate Sigurd, you know, like, I really dislike Sigurd. I'm like, well, you're not the only one. And definitely he's, you know, one of the things I did want to do was flip around the idea of this lone masculine hero. You know, one of the things I think it's interesting about that is, that most of the moments in his story are not actually that different in my novel than, you know, in the source material. I mean, there are different interpretations and different things, but if you think about like, well, yeah, he does trick Brynhild in the story and he does leave her and he does, you know, as you say, he sort of just marches along and says, well, I'll, you know, I'm the hero and this is what I do. And but looking at it from her perspective, and also, I mean, I did interpret things differently and think about motivations and that kind of thing differently. But it did feel to me like you could tell the story and the events would be pretty much the same. But depending on how you look at it, either he's, you know, this wonderful heroic figure, or he is someone who is just unable to accept you know, that he's not, or that you know, he's not perfect, and that he's not, he's sort of the unearned golden boy, and sort of the epitome of privilege in some sense, you know, even though he doesn't come from a privileged background, but he has this idea that he is the chosen one, and he's the one who's going to save the day. So it was very much a kind of deliberate subversion of the idea of the chosen one hero. And poor Sigurd kind of gets the brunt of that in my telling. I do feel a little bit badly for him because I think he is being manipulated, and but it's his own choice to kind of go along with that in the end. You know, he has agency. He has the ability to not be that guy, and he doesn't take the chance. He just, you know, he says, no, he can't see himself any other way, and eventually he just sort of goes down that path.
It does, and it really ramps up towards the end of kind of like of his climactic canonical death and end scene. And of course, it's only in your expanded ending where kind of Brynhild finds him in hell, and also kind of meets the Disir and Freya, that she kind of then learns that kind of like Odin was the one whispering all these suggestions, encouragements, misdirections. And I love how Odin is definitely a master of misdirection. I mean, even at the start when Brynhild says, okay, then tell me where to go if you are the all-knowing one. He goes, well, you can go left or you can go right. He goes, well, either way, I'm following what you want. I'm not doing it myself. And I think that really brilliantly reflected how Odin's presence is throughout kind of the entire Volsung line from before Sigurd's time all the way through to kind of like his and Gudrun's end, and that kind of thing is, he's always in the background pulling the strings. He's almost like he's more trickstery than Loki is. And speaking of Loki, there was one question that I did have firmly in my mind. Of course, with the scene that Loki's in, love to see more of that one. So if you ever want to do a Loki less novel, please do. Just saying. No pressure. Loki's definitely the flavour of the month, if not the century. He mentions how they mention how they're being used as kind of like a feint and misdirection. They've been sent to thieve something by Odin. I think, well, what is Loki thieving from Freya? Because I thought, I'm trying to think of all the myths that Loki thieves things, And the only thing I think of is something to do with her cloak, but in the myths that I know of, he didn't exactly steal it. He asked, she was a bit reluctant, and then she gives it to him. And I think it's mainly to do with the myth of Sif's hair getting lost and how he has to go fly off and speak to the dwarf. So I didn't know if you could maybe kind of like fill in that little hole that my brain is eager to know, kind of like, what was Loki doing?
Yes, yeah, yeah. No, I wonder if I'm going to be able to, because I'll have to think back. So one of the things that I was referencing there was, what is it called? The Brisingamen, which is her necklace. You know, so Freya has a necklace. Yeah, so, but I can't recall how I wrote it now, whether I decided that Loki was actually, you know, going to steal it at that moment or had stolen it before and there was a reference to it. So, but there is this sort of pattern of, you know, of some of the other gods going and bothering Freya about things, you know, that her necklace at one point, and there's that story. I'm trying to remember the exact. Freya's involved in this. There's a story where, you know, Thor and Loki both dress up as women, and Thor is the
The Lay of Thrym. Yeah. That's my favorite one. That is my favorite one.
Yeah,
yes, I'm pretty sure Loki asks if they can borrow Freya's necklace, and she says no. Unequivocally, no.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so I don't think there was any particular item that I thought that Loki was going to steal, if I'm remembering my own thought process correctly.
Don't worry, I know it's probably drilling into your memory somewhere.
Yeah, but it was sort of that pattern of, it seems like these guys are always going to bug her about something or to trick her or something like that. And I thought, okay, well, this will be one of those adventures.
So, going back then to Freya, kind of like, what was your thought process behind involving the Disir and having them be under her kind of like, not I say control, but certainly almost command influence, and certainly in a more amicable atmosphere from what we see in the book to the way the Valkyries are under Odin, where it's very almost like a military boot camp, but with Freya, they kind of like, they train the horses to fly, which I absolutely love.
As you say, the Disir are not, they're not as well known, I think, especially to sort of an Anglophone audience today. We don't have this sort of mental image of them the way that we do with the Valkyries. So one possibility for me was, you know, I thought, well, I could try to make them really similar to the Valkyries, but I think they do come from a slightly different folkloric strand, you know, like they have this association of being kind of spirits in a bigger sense, rather than the shield maidens, you know, of the Valkyries. So even though they're doing a similar function, especially in the interpretation that I've used here in the book, they're not exactly the same, you know, they're not exactly the same sort of being. So I kind of thought a lot about how to have this other set of female choosers of the dead, and, you know, how would they be different from the Valkyries, but how would they also kind of, they must have a relationship with them in some way. So they were a chance to create almost a kind of foil and say, well, you know, what Odin has created here is not somehow inevitable, you know, that he made choices for how he was going to deal with this system of the dead. And also I was really intrigued by the concept, which, you know, I didn't invent, of as you say, that the half of the dead in battle would go to Folkvang and half of them would go to Valhalla, and this sort of almost bureaucratic system of, you know, how do you choose which half, you know, like, and how does that all work out in practice, you know? It just seems sort of almost more symbolic than practical. So trying to figure out how that would look on the battlefield was a real challenge, and something that I felt like I had some scope to kind of invent a little bit there.
I really, really enjoyed it, because I've only been vaguely aware of them through my nonfiction reading, but I certainly, it made more sense than imagining kind of like Freya having loyalties to half the Valkyries, or having kind of like having to go to Odin to get her half, kind of like she then takes her half in her own right with her own crew of undead talent seekers, so to speak. And I think the, of course, the trying not to spoil any too much, but the way you've got, you have Brunhild kind of like after her death in the canonical legend, come back and actually confront Odin and challenge Odin even further. So like she challenged in the beginning and she got banished, and then she died because she got tangled up in his own further machinations. And then she still kind of like goes like, no, I'm gonna get my own allies. And she does. Amazingly, they're all again females. She speaks to Hel, she speaks to Fraser, even when I can speak English or even Norse. And she, together they do kind of almost set up a kind of a trap to get Odin to appear and actually kind of like say, oh look, we know what you're doing, we know you've done this, we know you've done that, and like, can you just stop now? Because obviously his manipulation of characters in the book and within the history, kind of not just the mythological characters but the historical ones, to generate even bigger wars and more wars, which I think you've again done really brilliantly to reflect how that impacts on the Valkyries as almost as a workforce, and that they then become overworked and they kind of like go blood frenzy and crazy, and then they don't care anymore about who is dead or alive. They're just going to have fun because it's chaos and that's all they can do to survive it, really. It did made my mind have a strange parallel to in British history when women started fighting in factories for better rights and better pay compared to men when they're all in the same factories, and how they ended up having to stand their ground and say, look, we do exactly the same job, so you need to pay us all more. And it made me think back to that and how it is literally a group of women, the Valkyries, Freya, Hel in her own way. And of course, Gudrun kind of like serendipitously finds the same moment and the same scene later on. And they all kind of like do get Odin and almost kind of like miss, well, Gudrun in particular, gives him that bit of information that lures him off, and you kind of like settle things. Oh, I love everything, as you can tell in my book. I probably said the word love more than anything else. How Odin tries to kind of like regain control of the Valkyries by saying, oh, Brunhild, oh, I'm so sorry. Just stop causing trouble and come back and join the forces. You can be immortal again. You can have your flying horse and whatnot. And Brunhild quite rightly says, no. you've kind of like, you've ruined my afterlife and then afterlife before that, and you're making too much mess. Because, and I think that rereading again for this analysis that I'm doing, and when Loki warns her kind of like, do you realize how many millions of people will be drowning in their own blood before all this is over, and I thought that was a really good ominous kind of like undertone for what Odin is effectively doing. He's just ramping up the wars, ramping up the conflict, all because he's driven by that insane need to get warriors for Ragnarok so the Ragnarok doesn't happen, so he doesn't die, and of course getting more knowledge to help in that whole inevitable fiasco, which I absolutely love. And the scene of it is brilliant. It reflects some of the kind of tales of Valkyries and how they have forms or cloaks of sort that they can take off, and just I'm trying not to spoil the ending, don't read it, but it's just so good. It's like the cherry on the cake by the time you reach the ending, I find, for me. And I just love it all. I really do. It's the kind of book that I dream of. And like back when I was a young wannabe writer, when I did creative writing at university, it kind of died off afterwards because procrastination in life and the lack of deadlines and too many books to read. I just had too many distractions and no discipline that I try to write about Valkyries myself, because I do find that there's so much unknown lore about Valkyries and their role and how they become one. Like we have 13 names in the poetic Edda, and they're all connected to battle type tomes or words or verbs, like host fetter and battle climber, and of course Hilda meaning battle, that kind of thing. And I think it's just such a rich gap for authors to fill their imagination, because of course we've got no one telling us we're wrong.
which is
the rich thing. And of course because of that, it allows it to be retold and adapted in so many different ways. It's why I found so many different books. I have got more than just the ones. I've got ebooks as well, which we felt carried in. And it's why I've found them so fascinating. So I'd love to know more about how you kind of like find Valkyries in your own fascination, any retellings, any other experience encounters, and why you think, I mean, even Marvel's brought along Valkyrie as a woman and they made her a king. So, so there we go.
Yeah. No, that's so wonderful to hear. And I feel exactly the same way. And, you know, I think one of the things that I find really fascinating about it is like you, the these little bits that we have in the Eddas, and you know, the names of the Valkyries, and the idea that there are probably these stories, you know, behind them that maybe we've lost, or that somebody might have known at one time. And so we don't have a lot, but what we do have is so fascinating. And the poem where Brunhild, I think she's has a different name, but she's sort of associated with Brunhild, where she does, you know, teach Sigurd the rune lore, which, as you say, I drew on in my book. You know, it's so wonderful that there's this female figure who is a warrior, and she's also the teacher. She teaches the hero, you know, how to make sure he doesn't get poisoned by his ale and all the rest of it. And so, yeah, it's just like you're saying, I think that these figures are really fascinating, and there's so much behind them that is yet to be explored. One of the things that was in my mind when I was writing this big battle at the end, and the context of the historical war that it's set in, you know, as far as I know, the sort of final battles with Attila were some of the bloodiest of all time, if you look at them sort of from a relativistic perspective of how many people died on the battlefield and that kind of thing. And they were quite horrific. And that concept of war, you know, we have these stories that are told from a culture that very much did find glory in war and battle. But also, you know, if we're looking at it today, and probably at the time as well, there's the other side of that, right? If you have these figures who are there to choose the slain on the battlefield, you know, there's a lot of horror in that. And there's a lot of questions that that raises for us today in a time when we're also, you know, witnessing absolutely horrific wars and death. And, you know, so I think that side of it, of, as I sort of bring all that together, I think that's what fascinates me about the Valkyries, is that there's the multiple facets of them, because not only are they there to choose glory on the battlefield, but they are also teachers and healers and the keepers of rune lore. And they have these wonderful personalities and stories and all the rest of it. So I think that there are many, many different ways to explore that for sure.
It's made me think again how much they almost reflect a slight weakness in Odin and his power, because of course, being a god, you would think, well, okay, you can go choose whoever you want to die and just get them yourself. But no, he needs Valkyries very much like the Christian god has angels, I suppose. Another probably religions and pantheons have their own kind of like soul collectors and soul guides. Of course, like in Greece, there's the boatman over the river Styx, I believe. There's all these kind of like these entities that can go in between. And I've always, like yourself, thought of Valkyries as they must have been human before, because they have that connection to us on the mortal realm. And most of the Valkyrie books I've read, they certainly, if not directly, come from a human background, but they definitely heavily involve themselves in human culture and society and events and drama and plot thickens and all that kind of jazz, a lot more than like the Norse gods do. I remember when, I think it was in, it was a podcast I did with the Orbit Viking Thing podcast, I had Professor Caroline Larrington, author Joanne Harris and Francesca Simon, and we were talking about why the Norse gods have such a connection with modern society today. And the point I said to them is that they're effectively human, they just happen to have apples that make them live a lot longer, which is incredibly corny, because doctors are always telling to eat us, and they, like an apple a day keeps illness away and all that kind of thing, because they display all the flaws of humanity. They're not innately good, but they're not innately bad. They've all got problems. Like Odin isn't the quite passive Odin of Marvel Cinematic Universe, although I will say when Hel came along, it seemed he did have quite a war frenzy reign, but then of course he downturned it all and went very passive. Whereas Odin isn't that kind of god. I think most, certainly from the historical fiction I've read, most of the warriors that kind of like beseech him when they're going to battle are the berserkers, because they do want to get that bloodlust, that craze, that kind of like no fear at all, and just kind of like daring and boldly going and doing things. getting bloody and crazy and just slaughtering a million people, whereas most of the sensible warriors kind of like worship Thor, because Thor was more the god of the people than Odin was. Odin, of course, was reflected more in the hierarchical society of the kings and the princes and the, maybe not the queens and that kind of thing. But I think you've also reflected that quite well with the Valkyries as well, especially when you describe how Valhalla is nice, but it's unendingly nice. And you do make the brilliant point of like how there's no change. And Brynhilde says like there's no consequences, there's no risk. We all die, but then we all come back up again. Like we kill the boar and it comes back again. We kill the boar and it comes back again. Like this is just like we can kill a boar 101 different ways and we'll still have 101 different days beyond that kind of thing. And I think that was a real good way of doing it. Again, so you mentioned Valkyries kind of like almost becoming bored of their own immortality, their own job. And of course, Brynhild and Sigurd are the kind of like the infamous, not unrequited love, but kind of like tragic love, very much like love, Romeo and Juliet, kind of like the dangers of a man falling in love with an immortal, well, not quite immortal, but kind of like a woman out of his league, so to speak, or and that whole mishmash with the disguise. You mentioned through Brynhild, of course, but I know it's you. kind of like she gives reference to other Valkyries deciding to also say, actually, no, I'm gonna play dangerously. I'm gonna fall in love with that guy because he's quite nice. And actually, no, you're not gonna kill him, Brynhild. Just put your sword away, and I'll just take him over here. I love that little scene how she just like led him to the woods, and then his hands, and then he saw her, and then his hands are all over, and I'm like, yeah, you probably would if you'd just been pulled off a battlefield and realised that a beautiful woman had saved your life. And of course, he of course has an ill fate. He does die in the end. He gets murdered. He doesn't get to go to Valhalla, so that Valkyrie doesn't get to see him. So she chooses to go and be with his ghost near his barrow, which I thought was a really fascinating touch, because then that's almost two spiritual beings from different planes and realms kind of like choosing to try and be together and defy the laws that usually separate them apart. So yeah, I think you explore kind of like the relationships as both romantic and sexual through a lot of these characters, really kind of like openly, well, and nothing seems shocking. It's all well in Omnicos, because we're much more aware of how diverse love is in the 22nd century, and we do hope that they were at least aware of certain loves like that back in the Viking Age, so to speak.
And it is a really complex set of stories, you know, and there's so much in it that you know, and as you say, like Odin, the old stories about Odin are quite complex, and he's such an interesting figure, and not at all you know, it always reminds me of the line from Lion and the Witch in the Wardrobe, where Aslan is not a tame god, you know, that he's and Odin is very much like that he's not predictable, and he's not always kind, certainly, and he's absolutely not assumed to be benevolent, which is a little bit you know, uncomfortable, I think, for many modern readers, because the concept of a god who is actually kind of a jerk a lot of the time is you know, not at all unusual for older mythologies, but it's not something that is sort of part of our daily life today. But I think one interpretation that I should mention, because it's definitely been you know, hugely influential on me, you know, I mentioned Neil Gaiman's Norse myths early on, but I think probably even more influential is American Gods, and his version of Odin in that story, which I think is absolutely true to the sort of classic interpretation of Odin, where he is not to be trusted, and you know, he has his own agenda, always has an agenda, and so that version of Odin, I think, was definitely really formative for me as well.
Oh, well, I'm glad I found someone else who thinks and knows kind of like the intricate depths and aspects of Odin kind of thing. So, yeah, gosh. Oh, how long did it take you to write Brynhild's story, The Valkyrie?
It's hard to say, because I have this habit of working on multiple things at once. So, I have... I keep my emails, you know, luckily, so I can always go back and see when I first wrote to my agent about something. So when the year that I wrote to my agent and I said, oh, I want to write this story about Brunhilde Valkyrie, was 2018. Mm-hmm. So I was working on it from then. And I think I was writing it from about 2018 to 2021, but I was working on other things at the same time. So I was, you know, revising my novel, The Embroidered Book, and I had, I was also writing my Assassin's Creed novels. And so often it'll be a case where I'll take 3 months to be drafting something, and then I'll have to switch to edits on something else and then go back to drafting. And so I think overall it was probably about 3 or 4 years, but not exclusively working on that. Yeah.
And how did you find the research level? Of course, as The Guardian brilliantly quotes on the front, it is a sustains a fine balance between history and fantasy, which of course is beautifully put, because as you said earlier in this, it has got touches of history in it. Attila the Hun, it did exist. Yeah. This myth legend isn't making it up. It just happens that he also seems to, it just has the mythological side thing. But as you said, kind of like these myths get retold and to things. So how did you kind of balance the research with the mythology aspect and of course the historical aspects, and how did you find marrying the two together?
I love the research part of it, you know, and that's always probably one of the reasons why I keep going back to historical settings with my novels, is that it's one of my favorite things to do, is to research and to think about how to fit a story inside of history. Yeah, the mixing, you know, trying to figure out how am I going to tell the story. And I did, I spent a long time at the beginning thinking, okay, I'm going to tell this in a kind of unnamed land. Like it's going to be, you know, sort of just story land, you know, like these things are going to be happening. But then the more I thought about it, you know, the more I read the source material, which is, you know, at its root, it did come from this story of this people that were attacked on the borders of the empire, and you know it's almost invisible there now in the story, but it's there, and I didn't want to lose that. I felt like it was important to the story that there was a historical happening, you know, just like the Iliad is the story of Troy, you know, like So I decided, okay, well, I am going to ground this in history, but then that gave me some challenges because I had to figure out how this would all fit together. And then I had to research a little bit about what this part of the Roman Empire would have looked like in the 5th century. And that part was quite challenging because it's not, you know, it's not to say that it hasn't been studied. It's been studied, but there's not a lot of popular history about the sort of Germanic, you know, client kingdoms on the edges of the Roman Empire is not a subject of a lot of popular history that I've found. So it's very, but you know, there's academic work, but it's not super accessible for someone just trying to get a sense of what was happening. But I love academic work, so I sort of dove into journal articles and stories about the Burgundians, and anytime I can find primary sources, that's always the best. So things like the Burgundian legal code still exists. We have it, and I found a translation of that, and so understanding their legal code helped me to understand what some of their norms and values would have been, and you know, things like how would they have eaten dinner? Would they have reclined to eat dinner because they were part of the Roman Empire, or would they have had chairs, you know, and just like stuff like that. It was just the amount of hours I spent thinking about whether or not they would recline or not to eat dinner. And eventually I ended up deciding that they would do both, that they would have like a Roman dining room and then they would have their sort of Germanic dining room, depending on which guests they're entertaining. So yeah, so I did get sort of deep into that stuff in terms of how can I make this feel grounded in real history? I always kind of over research. I do a lot of research.
Well, sounds like you enjoyed it, and I guess that's good because it does definitely come through, like the details, like between how Gunnar has to effectively fight for his kingship, and it's his uncle, I think, who picks Sigurd to be his champion because he simply comes across him and he's like, oh, he killed a dragon, can you just go defeat my nephew for me so I can I like that bit of politics, because that was something that I wasn't really aware of, because certainly in the Saga of the Volsungs you don't get that kind of culture of the Brigandians coming through, but you do it really well in your book. And the other question I was going to ask was, The Saga of the Volsungs certainly have little titles for each of their chapters and sections, and I do quite like the titles for your chapters, mm-hmm. and indeed, of course, your sections, because you've got about four sections. So yeah. Sort of like, did you struggle with any naming particularly chapters, or did they come out quite naturally when you've finally segmented them off?
I think they came pretty naturally for this one. And one of the things I wanted to do with the chapter headings in this one was just subtly signal to the reader, you know, whose story we were looking at, because I do have two first person narrators, and I know that can be confusing for readers when you have I and the I are two different people. So each of the chapter titles actually, you know, includes the name of the woman who's speaking, although there are a couple of times when it's like Gudrun talks to Brunhild or something, and then you have to, you know, really parse it to figure out, but for the most part, it's like, you know, when Brunhild speaks to the birds or whatever, then you know, okay, well, this is a Brunhild chapter. So it was just sort of a practical thing to, you know, to clue in the reader a little bit, although not everyone reads chapter titles or clues in that way. And the sections too, you know, just sort of the stories seem to fall into particular pieces that way. And it did give me a chance to kind of draw a little bit on just pull out some of the imagery and, you know, just bring the reader into what I really wanted them to focus on in terms of imagery and tone for those sections.
Well, I really liked it, and of course it made me think it's how the Saga of the Volsungs was written, but oh, she's copying it, but then of course, yes, I unconsciously wasn't aware that there was actually also telling me which character was speaking, although I am now, because I'm rereading it and going to all the Brynhild ones. Gudrun's kind of part is also kind of like significant and equal contribution, because as well as expanding Brynhild's ending beyond the Piocene, you've also expanded on Gudrun's ending, because I'm not quite sure, I can't specifically remember what happens to her as such after the burning of the pyre and the Saga of the Volsungs, but I quite like where you kind of gave her own kind of female independence and agency in different ways.
Yeah, and that was a tricky thing to decide, because so that's one place where the Nibelungenlied actually departs quite a bit from the Norse versions, or vice versa. But they're quite different in terms of what Gudrun's the ending of her story is. So you know, there are some versions of her story in which she takes revenge on her own brother and the men of what I call Vermatia, or the city of Worms in what is now Germany. So she actually turns on her family, and she goes off and marries Attila and uses that as a way to take revenge. And then there's other versions of the story where she revenges herself on Attila and burns down Attila's camp and kills him, which is probably inspired by the historical event, which is Attila, his death possibly happened at one of his wedding feasts, and he married this new wife, and she may or may not have poisoned him. Her name was Ildiko. And so that may have been the inspiration for the sort of Gudrun Kriemhild character taking refuge, taking revenge on him. And I have a little reference to that in the book as well. So I won't talk about which version I have in my story, but there are these long, and there are some of the versions also include other storylines long after this of what happens with Brynhild and Gudrun. And, you know, there's a Svanhild, who is another girl who comes into it later on. And so that was, I felt very much like there were several different possibilities I could do when it came to the ending. And, you know, the sort of big moment on the pyre and the choice of, you know, who pays for the death of the hero in some sense, it feels like a big climax, but there are other things that then happen and the way that story plays out. I feel very much like it could be a bit of a choose your own adventure at the end, you know, but I wanted them to have a particular kind of ending, which, I wanted this to be in the end about these two women. So that's sort of what drew me back to deciding how I was going to end this novel.
Well, I really salute it, and I salute you for your research, your writing, your talent and your clear passion for this. It comes through, and of course they do have a happy ending of sorts at the end, but it's of course Gunnhild and Brynhild are two women kind of like in this male dominated world, both divine with Odin and of course politically with Gunnar and the rivals of power, and of course it's all the Hun and war, and they really do stretch and push themselves to try and stand on their own two feet and find their own purpose and their own path regardless of what everyone else says. And I think that really of course speaks to so many women around the world trying to break through the patriarchal circle that dominates still a lot of society, and from business to parenting. I'm not gonna go on that one. So yes. But yeah. I really, really enjoyed it, and I do highly recommend that anyone in slight interest in Norse mythology or just wanting a really good feminist empowering story with a really lovely twist should do definitely go. It's so beautiful.
It's wonderful because it's so lovely to talk to you, because you know, when you're in the middle of writing a book like this, you know, and you get into the middle sections, when it just feels, you get despair and you think, why did I ever start this? You know, I can't finish it. I'm just, you know, this was a mistake from start to finish. And there's always that moment when you just feel like total despair. But I think what drives you forward as a writer is knowing that somewhere out there is a reader who is going to get it and is going to connect with it in some way. And so talking to you and knowing, well, you are that ideal reader, because you know, you have the background and you get it on so many levels. So it's a real joy to talk to you.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I don't have the courage, not the time, nor the energy, and definitely not the imagination to write anything as beautiful and as good. But I'm just grateful that there are women like you that do. And it's funny how a lot of the books, actually, that I read about Valkyries are written by women. A lot of the Norse fantasy I read generally is written by women, apart from Neil Gaiman and Snorri Kristiansen. I think there's really only a couple of men actually on my shelf. It's nearly all women, and predominantly white Western women, of course, which is another angle. I've always been curious about how the Norse, both in mythological and definitely the historical sense, is very much definitely kind of like a Western white hemisphere. There's not much interest or connection with kind of the wider global citizenship from the southern or far east kind of thing. Although getting into Norse mythology and anime is a definite topic for a different episode entirely. But yes, so thank you so much. I am all out of questions, because otherwise I'm just going to keep complimenting you and this and that, and I'll give away too many spoilers. But I really appreciate your time joining my humble little YouTube channel in my wonderful little series called Valhalla Conversations, and it really is, it's a conversation in Valhalla for me to be able to speak to wonderful creatives with equal passion and interest, and as I say, like-mindedness that we both share. So thank you very much, Kate.
Well, thank you. And I knew that when you asked me earlier on, that something would trigger in my mind that I would want to recommend a retelling. And it did, finally, just before the end. So I definitely want to recommend my friend Chadwick Ginther's books, The Thunder Road Trilogy, which is Norse mythology that is reinterpreted and reimagined in modern Manitoba, which is where I grew up, and has a strong Icelandic community. So definitely check out Chadwick Ginther's books.
Brilliant. Well, do ping me along his details and I'll make sure they will be in the notes below this video, dear viewers. So, of course, I promote and support all Norse. Anything Viking, it usually gets my money and my name shouting about it somewhere. But thank you so much for joining me. It's been a real privilege and honour and a real pleasure to talk about all this with you. And, of course, I wish you best of luck with all your future writing projects.
Thank you. Likewise.